Weather forecasters predict more snow and heavy winds tonight and tomorrow, with temperatures dropping well below zero. Back here in South Florida, we've got just the opposite problem. The heat and humidity are supposed to climb. Local beaches should be jammed. Our weather expert, Walter Cronice, will have the local forecast later on his watch.
Welcome to The Shining 237, the podcast where we look at Kubrick's horror masterpiece in 2 minute and 37 second bloody chunks. My name is Susan Tekla Kruglenska, and we are on episode number 28. We are going to be looking at the segment that begins with Halloran in his bedroom in Florida, and we hear a newscaster's voice saying, "Colorado is expected tomorrow to be declared a weather emergency," and we end with Jack smiling. And there's not a whole lot of dialogue in between there, but it is still a very exciting episode. And let me just also say that something very exciting happens at the exact midway point of this segment.
Oh, and I have something prepared to commemorate that.
Oh, good.
Yes.
Should we give it away now, what it is?
Absolutely not.
Okay. Something very important. This is a special episode, and that's why I asked both my two guests today, my favorite people to be on the show. One is New Yorker cartoonist Joe Dader.
Hello, I'm recording this laying on my bed, surrounded by pinups of funky soul sisters.
And the other is cinephile Megan Dooley.
Hi there, I am also recording this in my bedroom, but I'm surrounded by clothes that need to be folded.
Beautiful paintings of piles of laundry.
Yes.
On your forest green bedspread.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And your orange
with
walls.
with my feet out and or foot out and pointed up. Yeah.
Who uses those colors? Only Kubrick. So let's begin. And let me also say that we're at the end of the show. Also, more surprises. We're going to talk about, one, the Kubrick exhibit, the photo exhibit that's going on here in New York City at City Museum of New York. Joe and I went. We will talk a little bit about that. And the accompanying Taschen book, which I laid out 70 smackarinos to purchase so I can talk to you guys about it. And two, Joe and I also went to see Filmworker for the second time, and there was a Q&A with Alec Baldwin, Leon Vitali, and the filmmaker Tony Zierra, and we have some fun stuff. I got to talk to Leon Vitali a little bit, and we will talk about that at the end of the show.
Yay.
Yay. So, all right. So this episode. Okay, so we begin in Halloran's bedroom. We have spent the last segment pulling out from a TV and slowly revealing ourselves to be in this other bedroom and that we're in Florida. And then we have the camera.
Well, the camera is pulling out from Halloran. Then it cuts to the reverse angle of the TV that he's looking at. Then it cuts to pulling in a close-up. This is a really interesting segment to watch taken out of context from the rest of the film, because aside from the diegetic sound of the newscaster on the TV, there's no dialogue whatsoever for this 2 minute 30 second chunk, just music. Even though the scene cuts from actually three different locations, Halloran's bedroom, Danny's bedroom, to room 237, none of the characters in the film say a thing except for the newscaster, who says, "And would you mind, Susan, if I go ahead and repeat what the newscaster
said?" Please do.
He continues. Apparently, he was starting to say, "The governor of Colorado is expected tomorrow to declare a weather emergency. The National Guard might be called out to clear streets and roads. Weather forecasters predict more snow and heavy winds tonight and tomorrow, with temperature dropping well below zero." Back here in South Florida, exposition. Important information. Back here in South Florida, we've got just the opposite problem. The heat and humidity are supposed to climb. Local beaches should be jammed. Our weather experts will have the local forecast later on Newswatch.
Right. Well, we knew all that because we've seen the snow piling up on the overlook. But, you know, when he goes from the last scene we saw with Jack, Shelley was talking to Jack, and she's horrified about this old woman that Danny's telling her about, and he goes,
She says a crazy woman.
Crazy woman. Yeah. There's a crazy woman in the hotel.
Crazy woman. Jack doesn't know what to expect. He doesn't know if he's going to be meeting someone old or young or possibly sexy and naked and ready to
mingle. Give it away. Don't give it away. So,
but he is drunk. But we know he's drunk. So he probably drunk. Somewhere in the back of his mind,
ghost
he's drunk. Hoping.
He's ghost hoping. Drunk on ghost alcohol.
Yeah, he
when
is. He,
yeah. If you, when you're, there's a certain level of drunk where if someone says to you, there's a crazy woman over there, you're going to go over there thinking, maybe she's also naked and horny.
No, first you're going to say, are you out of your fucking mind?
Right.
Yeah.
Which is one of the craziest lines of the whole movie.
Yeah.
But we left Jack saying.
But let's not get ahead of ourselves.
No, yes. So we left with Jack saying, which room was it? And so that was the wonderful little ending there. That was a great, you know, ending line to leave. And then we ended up in front of, in the middle of a TV set that when we started pulling out. And so we had to orient ourselves because I think it's the most jarring segue in the whole movie. You're like, what the hell? Where am I? Where am I right now? And so, you know, the TV announcer is orienting us. Oh, okay. We're in Florida. Right. So we are not in Colorado where it is snowy. We are in sunny Florida.
It's an elegant way to get it across.
Yeah. And so we're in Halloran's bedroom. Again, notice both lamps on either side have no cord. Mm-hmm. We see a bunch of books, which I dying to know what they are, but we'll never figure out. They're just way too small. We have the beautiful painting. Some may say a little cheesy and offensive, but it's also beautiful at the same time. But we talked about this a little bit in the last episode. I forgot to say the name of that painting on the other side of the wall above the TV is Supernatural Dreams. Yeah. And it has the actress.
It's painted over a photograph. It's based on a photograph of this model, actress model named Azizi Johari,
right.
Who had been a Playboy centerfold in, I think, 1975.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And I remember her. I remember seeing
Do
that
you?
Issue as a young
no
man.
No way.
I remember my older cousins had that issue and them, yeah, I remember. you remember mm-hmm. these things when mm-hmm. when you're young. So yeah, I definitely remember, and I remembered her name even. And but I, you know, I didn't know that was her in that image until now. But
was her hair that big?
I certainly know who she is. No, not at all. She actually, in a lot of the things I've seen her in, a lot of her, if you Google her, you can see a lot of photos of her where she has, you know, she has conked hair, sort of artificially straightened hair.
Right.
I don't ever remember her in real life seeing a picture of her with that kind of a crazy afro. It's very much, I think that's the part of it that's the artistic license.
It's an exaggerated. I mean, obviously, everything about it. And she actually was an actress. She's on album covers. She's modeling, and she was in John Cassavetes' movie Chinese Bookie. What's it called?
I was going to say it must be Killing of a Chinese Bookie.
Yeah,
so many
it.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, isn't was it Turis Satana in that?
Oh,
I
could
think,
be.
Or is it Haji? One of Russ Meyer's or a couple of Russ Meyer's women, but a lot of interesting women show up in Killing of a Chinese Bookie.
Yeah, she's in that. So anyway, so this other painting, I have not been able to identify at all.
This is the one that's on the wall right over Halloran's headboard.
Yeah, it's red.
And it's bright red, and it shows a woman in profile on her knees. She has a not quite as big afro, but both of these mm-hmm. paintings are
still
sort
pretty
of like,
big.
They both fall under the 1970s Black is Beautiful type, poster art you might see.
Right. And it looks like something they picked up at a thrift store, you know, just as the other one. And of course, you know, the slight controversy here is, you know, is this a little bit racist that they have Halloran in a room with these naked Afro chicks, or is it very 70s? Is it very much what?
Oh, it's very 70s.
Yeah. It seems like, yeah, okay, he can appreciate the female form. That's...
Yeah.
I mean, I'm a middle-aged white man. It's not for me to declare, like, what is racist and what isn't, but I would be very surprised if having a Dick Halloran, who is an African-American man, having him have sexy pinups of African-American ladies is racist. I don't
know. Yeah, I only bring it up because it has been brought up. You know what I mean? And so I turn over every rock, you know, as far as this movie goes. Of course, like I said last episode, if they had had Slim Pickens as
that
Halloran,
would be weird.
That would be weird.
Be a
that would be very weird.
That would stand out like crazy.
But,
yeah.
But B, they may very well have had him with a topless white chick. You know what I mean? Like that. Mm. You know, images like that.
And back then in the 70s, chicks was not looked upon as a bad thing. It was chicks, broads, dames, skirts, birds, what have you.
Now remember when we were kids in the 70s and you'd walk like down the boardwalk? We used to go to the Jersey Shore a lot because my grandmother lived there. And I mean, just that was like for prizes for, you know, tossing balls into little basketball hoops and stuff. These were the kinds of prizes.
Yeah, sexy pinups.
You would see this kind of art. You'd see T-shirts with these kinds of things on them. You know, this is the age of Keep on Truckin', Robert Crumb, where if you dug into his whole scene, man, he had some really dirty stuff. You know, I mean, his a lot of his art was quite graphic. And that was all over the posters and T-shirts of the 70s, you know. Mm-hmm. And so,
and
yeah.
Most often on the side of vans.
Yes.
Vans.
Carpeted vans.
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. And if you went into any sort of poster shop, you would find your rock posters and your sexy girl posters. Those seem to be the two major categories of things.
Or psychedelic posters.
Your psychedelic black light posters. Dr. Strange on them.
Yeah.
And Jimi Hendrix. And then there would be the various types of, you know, sexy girl posters that, you know, alongside the Cheryl Teagues. And the, you know, and the Farrah Fawcett's. That was always a thing.
I think of that sort of, what was it, Conan the Barbarian. Is it Frank Frazetta?
Yeah.
Sort of like super muscular guys with the unclad women with tiny little bits of metal and fur kind of covering the important parts.
Yeah.
That was the art.
Just getting back to Killing of a Chinese Booksy, it was Haji was in it.
Haji, right.
And also Timothy Carey. Okay,
yeah,
so
and
that reminds me, I'm having a roundtable for The Killing on my Patreon. We're recording it soon, and one of the roundtable guests will be none other than Megan Dooley.
Me.
Yes, that will be fun. Okay, so again, we're looking back at the TV and Supernatural Dreams. Now, let me mention again the album covers on either side. We last week solved the, I think, exclusive to the Shining 237 podcast. We solved one of those albums on the floor is Steel Eye Span, Commoner's Crown, which features none other than Peter Sellers. Joe Dater, fan of Peter Sellers. Did you even know about that album?
I had no idea, and I then went and listened to it on YouTube.
Yes. So Peter Sellers is on the last track. He plays ukulele. He does some riffing.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, he does some. Listen to my last episode. So that has a Peter Sellers. So that's like a little Peter Sellers tribute, I think, that Kubrick put in. It's an Easter egg for Peter Sellers, who, sadly, as Joe mentioned to me recently, died just a couple months after this film came out. So that's very poignant. And also, let me say, that's the only mainstream album he was ever on, except for the being with the Hollies for After the Fox. He did a lot of other albums, but it was, you know, kind of comedy stuff, right? He wasn't really on any other. I think those were the only two.
I think he did a record, but it was him like kind of talk singing the Beatles.
Yeah, he did a number of Beatles songs that way, where he would do them as Shakespearean soliloquies. And then he did the opposite one where he would do Now is the Winter of Our Discontent in a Beatles accent, just he would sound like John Lennon doing the speech from Richard III. And he did another one where he did the lyrics of the song She Loves You as a conversation between two men, which it is in the song, but when it's always been a funny song to me, because I always thought, if you actually listen to the lyrics, that one guy telling to the other guy she loves you is really overstepping his boundaries there. I think he should probably mind his own business.
Yes. If I were the girl, I'd be like, yeah, I'd be kind of pissed off about that.
Ah, hello, Nigel.
Yeah, hello.
Well, now, cut a long story short.
Hmm?
You think you've lost your love. Well, I saw her yesterday.
Hmm?
It's you she's thinking of.
Hmm.
And she told me what to say. She says she loves you.
Yes?
Yes. She loves you.
Yes.
She loves you.
Yes.
Yes.
Hmm. He did a lot of albums. He had a hit single with him and Sophia Loren.
Yes, I noticed there was a lot.
Wow.
Well, here's what happened. He did a movie with Sophia Loren called The Millionaires. If I may digress for a moment to talk about Peter Sellers. Yeah, he did a movie called The Millionaires, And in it, he did something you can't do now, which is he played an Indian man. It's a very light, goofy comedy. But then the two of them did a single together. It was called Goodness Gracious Me. It was that, you know, he plays this very stereotypical, you know, Apu-like caricature of an Indian man. So it's Goodness Gracious Me. It's exactly what you'd imagine that would be. Of course, what happened with Peter Sellers and Sophia Loren was that Peter Sellers was kind of crazy. And over the course of filming The Millionaires, he had become convinced that she was in love with him.
Yeah.
And he had maybe misinterpreted her Italian way of being. And so he went home one day and announced to his wife, Sophia Loren is in love with me and I'm leaving you for her. And Sophia Loren had no idea about this. This was news to her. And she was married to Carlo Ponti at the time and had just, she thought he was out of his mind. And so
that was that.
So it was in fact the end of his marriage to his first wife, Anne, but not in fact the beginning of a relationship with Sophia Loren.
Yeah.
From New Delhi to Darjeeling, I have done my share of healing, and I've never yet been beaten or outboxed. I remember that with one jab of my needle in the Punjab, how I cleared up beriberi and the dreaded dysentery. But your complaint has got me really foxed.
Oh, doctor, touch my fingers.
Well, goodness gracious me.
Yeah, it's an interesting chapter. But so anyway, digression ended, and we're back into the room with Dick Halloran and the two albums on either side.
Yeah, let me say the Right Side album I posted on Twitter and Facebook. I've been trying to, you know, see if we could figure out what that one is, because we actually successfully did the other, but so far no dice. It's a really hard one to tell what it is. Anybody wants to go to my website or Twitter or Facebook, look at it and let me know if you know what it is. But I did ask Leon Vitali, because I got to see him Friday night at Filmworker, and I told him about the album discovery, and he said he just doesn't remember. So yeah, he's one of the only people.
But it's probably in a notebook in his attic somewhere.
I wonder if Vivian Kubrick knows.
It's got to be in a notebook in his attic somewhere. I mean, we saw in the film, Filmmaker, that he kept meticulous records of everything for Stanley. And I'm sure there were records of the set dressings.
Yeah, it's something to pursue. I'd like to pursue it further, for sure. All right. So anyway.
Well, I have a question, because since this segment started with the TV and the previous segment, did you talk at all about the newscaster on the television?
Glenn Rinker. I did. I brought him up. I mentioned he died pretty young. He is a real newscaster, just like in 2001, Kubrick used a real, you know, mission control person to do the talking to the astronauts to make it sound very authentic. Here again, in all the news segments in this movie, he used real news people, gave them scripts, but used real news people.
And that's what all news people of that time looked like.
Yes. Yeah.
Every town had one. The same dry look hair. Every town had one of those.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was. If you were in the New York area, we had Roger Grimsby.
Yes. Yeah. Ernie Anastas with sports.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's a little more info on him, but I don't want to say because it's gossip and it's not positive. Okay. So you can look it up, but you know, who knows what's true.
Well, I'd prefer to remember. Yeah, I'd prefer to remember. I'd prefer simply to remember Glenn Rinker of WPLJ Florida, the way he appears in this film, telling us of Colorado's expected weather emergency,
In Florida,
which is something that people in Florida aren't necessarily going to want to know. Uh-huh. The first thing people in Florida are going to want to know is that Colorado is going to have snow.
Exactly.
Because that's big news, that Colorado is getting snow.
Yeah. Right.
And then the next thing they might want to know is what's happening where they are in South Florida.
And that they might be swimming, which in Florida, humidity. I mean, come on.
Yeah.
Who would have thought you'd be swimming in Florida?
Breaking news, Floridians. There's snow expected in Colorado.
And we may be going to the beach.
Yep.
Yes.
Imagine. Mm-hmm. Okay, so as we are pulling back in now, and I love the flow, the ebb and flow of the camera movement, we are beginning to hear some music. And we start even hearing a heartbeat.
A heartbeat, yeah. I realized that because I watched when I watched the clip and then I watched it back again, but I just listened to it. I didn't actually watch it. And it was really interesting to hear it like kind of fade, the regular sound fade out. And then it comes up and yeah, you hear all these strange kind of like orchestral sounds and then the heartbeat. And it's like, oh, it really is a heartbeat.
It's like when you get up too fast and everything, suddenly you can't hear anything. And it's like, you know, everything goes black. I don't know if anybody else has this experience. I used to have it a lot when I was younger where, you know, your blood pressure just shifts really rapidly and suddenly the sounds that are around you disappear and all you hear is that rushing sound and everything goes black. It reminds me of that experience. He captures that feeling, you know, and so heartbeat, the music comes in and then suddenly Halloran is looking upward and his mouth is hanging open and he's breathing heavy and oh my gosh, that tight close. I mean, just such a tight close up. It's unbelievable. It's like his front lip is blurred. We're so tight in the picture.
It seems like he's been rendered immobile.
Yes.
Like he's laying there and he can't move and the camera slowly closes in on this in his face and the flaring of his nostrils and this increasingly terrified expression on his face.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he's trembling.
Yeah.
And then we cut to room 237. We see the inside. And then just, you know, that's just a flash that you're not even hardly supposed to notice. But it just orients you back to the hotel.
And it's kind of a weird, like, as the two shots of Halloran and Danny are both on, you know, the steady camera work. The one in the hallway is kind of that weird shaky handheld.
Yeah. Well, I think that's on purpose, and we'll see in a minute why. Yeah, we'll see why in a minute. Although I'm surprised it's not even higher up on the door, but we want to see that room 237 keychain.
I have some good news, which is having not been able to find the painting on the back wall in DeCalleran's room, I did find the painting that's right over the lamp in room 237.
Oh,
really?
What is that?
Yes.
How can you even see what that is?
It's called Dog Boy and St. John River by one Alex Colville, 1958.
Good Lord.
Wait, so you can see that in the later part of
it? Not the one that's over the fireplace.
No, it's right when the door is slightly ajar and there's a lamp in the background and a painting right behind the lamp. By the way, you know what we didn't mention? When we cut to the close-up of the camera closing in on Halloran's terrified face, the painting right behind his head is not there. The sexy girl painting behind him is low enough to be behind the headboard of his bed in the previous shot, but then when we cut to the close-up, it's gone completely.
Yeah, they probably looked through the viewfinder and said, nah, it's distracting, move it.
He would have tidied it up.
Assuming that no one's going to be going through this minute by minute.
Yeah.
Ever.
Right. Who would do that?
Dissecting. That would be a fool's errand to
exactly.
Do that,
what kind of a crazy person does that with a movie? There's not even the technology available to do it. So, things are just going to go past the audience. They're not going to notice these things in the background at all.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. So let's get to Danny. Poor Danny. Yes. Oh, poor Danny.
Poor Danny.
Danny's having a fit. Oh, that's your basic fit right there. Did not know he was in a horror movie. Let's keep
that
in mind.
They should have gotten him one of those dogs that can sense a fit coming on, and they just kind of lay down and keep you still in one place.
Oh, God, if he had a dog in this movie...
Since it's a Stephen King movie, it would either go rabid and attack him, or it would end up dead or drowned in the bathtub or something horrible.
But this is a boy who could have used a dog, yes, or a cat, anything, a hamster would have been helpful.
Mm-hmm.
But instead, he's alone in his bed, drooling and shaking. This poor kid. And so him and Halloran
He didn't know
are...
he was in a horror movie.
They did not know he was in a horror movie.
He just thought he was in a perfectly normal movie where they tell you to look terrified all the time and foam at the mouth.
Mm-hmm. Poor Danny. He's five. He didn't know. He didn't have any context. All right. So there's a clear connection here between him and Halloran. They're both trembling and freaking out. And we are now in this fabulous room.
Boy, what a room it is.
I love these colors. I love them. I mean, I know they're so cheesy. I love them. The purples and
the luridness. I mean, especially after that kind of 70s look of, you know, that rust and avocado and mustard yellow, harvest gold.
Yeah.
And then
yeah.
to go to this, like, deep purple with green peacock feather almost shaped rug and then light lilac furniture.
Yeah. And the yeah. rug is the perfect.
And the dark striped curtains.
I love the curtains. I want those curtains. Like, I just can't tell you.
I want that couch. I would like yes. a lilac couch like
that's
that.
Yes.
It's beautiful. Yeah.
The two. And then even the boring beige walls kind of just totally work. And but the rug, this is our I love this rug is like a cross between, like you said, peacock feathers and mm-hmm. like phallic symbols. You know,
I call it mm-hmm. Wi-Fi penises.
Wi-Fi penises.
Okay. Yes. Yeah.
It if you look at it just straight, like just a print of it, like just, you know, just nothing but the carpet. If you like, you know, you can just Google image and find some images of it. It is so phallic. It's ridiculous. It's so funny. So we are as
no
we
no cords on any of the lights either.
Yeah, oh, there is one as we get a little further on.
I did see a cord.
Wow. The one that's on the as we are turning the far side of the couch, you do see a cord. So that was a mistake because all the other cords are missing. Absolutely, it was
yeah.
they were
tucked
missing,
away. Yeah,
they were missing in Halloran's room. Too.
And I'm glad you mentioned that, Megan, because if you freeze the frame. Where when you see the cord and the shot is looking at the lavender couch and that you see the two lamps, that is about 1 minute and 18 seconds into
yes.
this segment.
Yes, I'm on it right now. Yes.
Yes, that was oh. so we are exactly one halfway through the movie.
Woo.
Woo. We made it. Sound halfway. Effect of champagne popping.
Yay.
Yeah, there are 55 episodes to this podcast. So, and basically, so yeah, we you know, if you divide the movie, this is the midway point. It is when you are looking straight on to the purple couch, to the gorgeous deep purple curtains, and it's a oh. symmetrical shot. So there you go.
Well, I have a song to commemorate the middle of the film. And it's very brief, but hit it. Well, I don't know why I came here at all. I'm riding on my big wheel down the hall. There's some scary twin girls over there. And a guy doing something with a bear. Room 237. It's not exactly heaven. Here I am, stuck in the middle of the film. I apologize. I'm sorry. That was terrible.
That was
really terrible.
Yes.
Thank
you.
I'm floored. That was beautiful.
I like that, yes.
Thank you, Joe.
My band didn't show up. It would have been better if they showed up. I had the band booked. They didn't show up. It really didn't turn out as
so listen, Mr. Painting Guy, I want to talk about the paintings, too, very quickly in this room. Do you know that is on top of the fireplace, what the picture is there?
No, I don't.
So you know the picture that nobody can make out, but you don't know this one.
Yes, that's right. Well, do you have it?
No, I
don't have it.
I don't. Okay. But I
apocalyptic sunflowers.
Well, I also tried to find the painting just off to the right of the bathroom door.
Right. We haven't gotten there yet. Hold on. We're not there yet.
Sorry.
So now we are, that's the living room part of the suite. It's a very nice suite. And then we walk up the steps and we're a little unsteady. And so at this point we look over, we're kind of like looking over to the bed and the pictures above the bed, and that gives us this feeling that we are a person.
It's very dreamlike.
Yeah, we're not a camera. Yeah. We're not a smooth camera. We're a person walking, and that orients you to what's going on here, where we were Jack saying, "Where's the room?" and approaching the door, and now we kind of may start to realize that we are Jack in the room. Checking out what's going on. We're teetering around the bedroom like we're drunk, which we are drunk. We're fake. Yeah. We're ghost drunk.
And we're stepping over the bed, which, you know, your parents would be like, no, you do not walk on the bed.
Yeah, we're
and once again, lurid kind of like, more like a swingers crash pad kind of a fabric on the bed.
Yes, I love it. Yeah, it's almost like he like kneels up on the bed and then like kneels over the bed. It's pretty funny.
Purple and green throw pillows. It's
purple and green throw pillows. Mm-hmm. And then on the right there is a picture of a fox. That I can see. That's a fox.
Yeah, I looked up that painting and I can tell you definitively I could not find it.
Do you have other information? I'm sorry I blew you off before, but that other picture that you were talking about when we first entered the room, I mean, did you have more information you wanted to say about that?
Well, no, not at all. I have the name of the painter and the name of the painting, and you can look that up if you want.
Okay.
What is it again? Dog Boy?
Yes, it's Dog Boy.
It's Whistler's,
Whistler's beloved Dog Boy.
It's actually
Dog Boy and Bear Man.
Exactly.
We see themselves come to life later on. Right, out of the painting.
Dog Boy and Bear Man number one is one of the most valuable comics you can get on eBay. it's Dog, comma, Boy.
Ah, okay.
Not Dog Boy.
I thought you were joking when you said Dog Boy. This has got to do with those two weirdos later on. Yeah.
It's Dog Boy and St. John River,
yes.
Not Dog Boy and St. John River, though that would be a very exciting
painting.
It's like
Eat, Shoots, and Leaves. Got it. Okay.
Yeah. And it's by Alex Colville, 1958.
Mm-hmm. I mean, Rob Ager has some of these. He's one of the conspiracy theorists who we've mentioned a few times of The Shining. He's one of the main, like, he has some interesting stuff that makes sense and a lot of stuff that doesn't and goes off the rails. But he does have one page that has all the paintings isolated. It's a lot of nature paintings. And then, of course, there's a lot of, you know, Native American themes. Anyway, so yeah, it is, you know, it's interesting to look at, but it's probably pretty insignificant. All right, so here we go, guys. Are you ready?
Mm-hmm.
We are entering the bathroom. We see a hand. Whose hand is that? Oh, yeah, Jack's. That's Jack's hand. And he pushes the door open, and we see this really funky bathroom. It's got cutout arches, and it's got, you know, again, the colors.
I love this bathroom.
It's beautiful.
With the metal, they all have the metal, like, legs on it.
Yeah.
And it looks like it has a bidet. Is that a bidet?
Of course it does. How could it not have a bidet? Yeah. Why in America do we not? What is wrong with us that we don't have bidets? But of course this one does. I notice that the sink and toilet and possible bidet colors match the walls, which is just so awesome.
Oh, it's
green
wonderful.
Porcelain. Love it.
Yeah.
The floor matches the arches, the shapes of the arches.
It's a wonderful bathroom, and I would want a bathroom that looked just like this if it hadn't been in this scene in this movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which would make it impossible to have this bathroom.
Yeah.
And you just can barely make out a figure behind that beautiful lace curtain. And we cut back to Jack, and he is terrified. This is the first time we see him just absolutely gobsmackingly terrified. We see this, and this is just one of the absolute scariest scenes, even though there's nothing really scary about it, but you just see this, barely able to see this hand come across. And she pulls that
very elegant hand with pointed fingers.
So smooth and slow. And the shock of her upper body, seeing her breasts so clearly, and the distance. Again, it's like the twins or like the woman in the movie The Innocents that we've talked about so much. That distance is what's so scary. If she had been, if they had shot her in a close up, it wouldn't have been scary. You just didn't expect to see that. You kind of, even if you know the story a little bit, you know, there's some scary lady in the bathroom. You did not expect to see a gorgeous woman. And it just is one of the few times in cinema history and horror history where a absolutely gorgeous woman is terrifying.
Yeah. And the only reason she's so terrifying is she shouldn't be there. No one should be there.
Yes. Yep. Nobody should be there. Yes.
Yeah. And the movie has brought you to this point where the mere appearance of a perfectly normal looking person is terrifying.
It's also that she's just perfect the way she does that smooth little reveal. It's just perfect.
Yeah.
And we have Jack suddenly change from terrified to, kind of happy.
Yeah. Oh, say.
Oh, say.
Yeah.
Hi.
Hello.
Drunken,
horny bastard.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the next episode of this podcast, we will have a lot more on this lady, who she is. The whole next podcast is like this really, it's the one of the greatest scenes in the whole movie. It's also one of the most awkward scenes in the whole movie. So I'm going to have Dan McCoy from the Flophouse on. We don't even know each other. So it's going to be just like oodles and oodles of awkwardness and nakedness. And
ask him about butts.
And I'll ask. All right,
He's
I will.
He's a fan of butts.
Okay.
He's a butt expert, a butt connoisseur, if
well,
you will.
Well, it's the perfect, there we go.
There are two of them in this scene.
Yes, mm-hmm. So I'm in perfectly good hands for the next podcast. Everybody tune into that. All right, so thank you guys for taking me through that, and congratulations to all of us on halfway through the movie, and we will be doing
more
this.
You're more than halfway through now.
Now we're more than halfway through. This will be going till about early-ish November. It's been such an incredible 6 months. We've covered so much incredible ground. We've actually discovered things, I think, and nobody else has ever really talked about in this movie, and there will be much more of that over the next half of the movie. So let's talk a little bit about a couple of tangential things. So Joe and I went to the Kubrick photography show at City Museum of New York. That's up through that's going to be up through October, and then it's going to be touring, so hopefully some of you all will be able to see it. And in conjunction with that, there is a book out from Tashin Press, of course, the incredible art house bookshop that puts out expensive but beautiful and worth it books of Kubrick's photography. It's about his years as a photographer for Look magazine. And it's very inclusive. It covers everything. So we also, on my Patreon, have a little video of Joe and I going through the exhibit, showing some highlights. So that's really fun for you Patreons. Or join my Patreon.
It is really fun. We had a fun time.
We had a fun time. So Joe, so the exhibit was wonderful. It's small, but it's fantastic. He got a couple of photos published when he was in high school in the Bronx, and then they hired him right out of high school. He couldn't get into any colleges because his grades were not high enough. You know, school kind of wrecked him for being a good student, which I think it did a lot of us who maybe have a bent for creativity. And so he was hired to Look magazine, you know, when he was a teenager, still just out of high school. So it was 5 years, I think, he was there. And so reading through the book, I purchased the book, and reading through the book, it's actually a lot of his photos were posed, like a lot of the ones that don't look posed were posed. Which that kind of drives me a little crazy. Like, I'm not crazy about them not being authentic, but at the same time, it's Look magazine. I mean, everything is very clean and, you know, family friendly, but also it clearly helped him to learn to be a director, right? Besides composition, lights and darks, artistic vision that would become part of his cinematography, working with humans, putting, you know, posing them in certain ways and obviously having to negotiate with them personally to get your artistic vision on film was something that probably helped him later in his movie life.
Yeah, and maybe I'm reading too much into it, but there were a number of photographs in the exhibition that I thought were almost precursors to the films he would make later.
Yes,
almost allusions to them.
I was going to say that. There was a set of boxing photos. Obviously, there's the boxer... Cartier, who he ended up, his very first film was about that boxer, his very first little short documentary short. There's also a racetrack set of photos that included, you know, even paper flying everywhere, you know, paper all over the ground and windy pictures, which could not help linking to if you've seen The Killing.
Yeah.
There's a boxing match in Killer's Kiss.
Yes, that's right. Also in Killer's Kiss. That's right.
There's a photo of a scientist at Columbia University who's a very sort of scary looking guy wearing dark glasses that very much suggests Dr. Strangelove.
Yes.
And there's an odd photo we found of just something happening involving a mascot.
Yes, there's a mascot, and it does, a mascot. Yep, there's a mascot.
A
little guy dressed up. And in the book, this was not in the photo exhibit, but in the book, there's actually a set of pictures from a sort of a costume ball, the Beaux-Arts Ball in Philadelphia in 1949. Oh. And it is a little reminiscent of Eyes Wide Shut. You know, it's a little bit, it's very rich people all dressed up with masks on and that kind of thing. Now, surprisingly, they did not include in the exhibit, he has these photos of deaf girls. I had mentioned them way back in the podcast a while back, where he has these little girls who are trying on they're deaf and they're trying on hearing aids for the first time. And there's two sisters who look very much alike, and they're even sort of looking at a mirror, so there's a twin effect, and they're wearing very similar dresses to the Grady twins in the movie. I had seen one photo of them that reminded me very much of the twins, but in the book there's even another photo that I had never seen that's nowhere on the internet, where they even look more like the Grady twins. So I'm really surprised they didn't include that, because it certainly certainly, honestly, I know it's easy for us to project in retrospect, but honestly, it really evokes them quite a lot. It's a little startling. There's a lot of everyday women in his photographs, a lot more women in his photographs than there are in Kubrick's films.
I noticed that too.
Yeah. But a lot of showgirls. Man, that was the age of showgirls, like the 40s, yeah. late 40s. You know, so funny. It's like every...
Yeah, I love that photograph that he took of the one in her dressing room.
Yes.
Yes. I saw that one.
Yes, it's like very vertical looking thing.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Right? It's yes. like almost you're on top of them, and it kind of goes... It's like a Japanese print almost. It's like... goes up into space. That's a wonderful photograph. I think so. That was one of the ones that was either at the Copacabana or the Stork Room, I think. Mm. Yes. And there's just tons and tons of showgirls. We should bring the showgirl back, I think.
And not yeah. the one of Paul Verhoeven.
Different showgirls.
No,
yeah.
different.
Not that yeah. kind of showgirls.
Is that that kind of put the nail in the coffin, I guess, for showgirls. Yeah. All right. And then the other thing is that Joe and I went to see Filmworker, the documentary by Tony Zierra, and we had seen it. I had seen it a while back at the New York Film Festival,
yeah, I hadn't.
Like last fall, and now they've reshowed it here in New York City, and it's traveling around a little bit. So if you can, if it comes to your town, you have to see it. It's about Leon Vitali, who we've mentioned a lot on the show. He was starred in Barry Lyndon, and then he, after that, became an assistant to Kubrick, who did everything from changing the litter box to checking for color in Kubrick's, you know, in reproductions of Kubrick's movies, which was very important to Mr. Kubrick. So he did everything from including some of the work that Kubrick really felt was the most important stuff you could possibly do for him. And Mr. Vitali was there. Alec Baldwin was there. With Q&A afterwards, I actually booed Alec Baldwin. I booed Alec. All right,
but you have to explain why you right. booed him, because so, yes. it was more than justified. Your booing was more than justified.
Please to explain.
He yes. took a punch at Wendy. You don't yeah. take a punch at Ooh. Wendy.
He trashed when, no, Shelley Duvall.
No. When I'm in the room. Yeah. He said something like, yeah, I think we all wish that Wendy would have gotten lost in some snowdrift or something like that.
Shut up.
And the audience...
Shut up, Baldwin.
The audience was silent. And then I just sort of put my hand up and went, boo. So anyway, but I did raise my hand later. I got to ask a question, which was just something about Leon Vitali's father, because I think Kubrick was kind of a father. He had a very violent, not the best father. He had a very, you know, traumatic childhood, really. And I think Kubrick was, was definitely a father figure to him. So anyway, Joe, what did you think of the film?
I really liked it. I mean, it was absolutely fascinating. But I'm someone who, like, any insight into Stanley is just catnip to me. I'm drooling over it to find out more about what his process was like and what he did behind the scenes. And there's a lot of that. There's no way you can do a documentary about Leon without it being about Stanley. And so it is really about Kubrick. And I can kind of, I can kind of get it where Leon was coming from. You just, he wanted to be a part of something great. And he wanted to be a part of Stanley's work, because he felt that Stanley's work was just transcendent. And he just wanted to play some role in it, any role whatsoever, even if it was administrative or, you know. I would like to know the amount that he knows about film production, because it must be staggering.
Yeah. It's amazing that he didn't become a director or something himself, you know, that he yeah, put in all yeah. of that time and work and gained all that knowledge and then didn't do his own thing. He had a whole career as an actor, very successful career, was then asked after finishing Barry Lyndon, Barry Lyndon, to be in the Rush.
Oh, you haven't seen Larry Bindon?
Larry Bindon.
Oh, it's not quite as good. It's really a very different film in so many ways.
All shot with artificial lighting as much as possible. Yes, it's really amazing.
Exactly. But he after that movie, he was asked to be in the Royal Shakespeare Company. I mean, and he turned it down to do, like, you know, kind of grunt work, a lot of grunt work for Kubrick. So yeah. it's a fascinating story, but
what,
it was
what
exciting.
What was interesting was to learn that when Kubrick was not making a film, if you worked for him, you were not less busy there was an endless amount of work to do for Stanley, even when he wasn't in production on a film.
Right. And then, of course, the projects he didn't end up doing, like Napoleon and the Aryan Papers, that was, they were all working on that stuff.
Oh, yeah. He was in, I mean, he was often in production on films that he didn't finish. Yeah.
Now, when I, so in like episode 5 of this podcast, we had Elizabeth Yaffe, who I hope we will have on again at some point. She's the producer of Film Worker. And she, I had said to her that there was this fantastic cat anecdote that I didn't want her to tell because I wanted people to see it in the film because it's so funny. And they cut it out of this. So they edited, this was actually quite a re-edit from what I had seen in the fall at the New York Film Festival, and they actually did cut a few things out. So I have a feeling the Kubrick estate kind of said, eh, we don't really want that in. But I will tell you the anecdote that they cut out. So the anecdote that is what's still in the film, and we all know, Meg and I have talked about this on the podcast, that he loved cats, he loved dogs, mm-hmm. he was an animal nut. And when you cat sat for him, you got a Bible of instructions on how to deal with these cats and all this stuff. And so when his cats, one of his cats got sick, he would just, everything would, that's the only thing that would stop him from working was his worry over his cats or dogs. And so we had this one cat, I think his name was Jennifer. Was it Jennifer?
Jessica, the cat.
Or maybe Jessica, it was Jessica. And it was dying. And so he actually had people train cameras onto this cat and have it continually broadcast in so that he could always keep an eye on this cat. He had monitors in his other rooms so he could watch this cat. It was like 16 years old. He wouldn't let it die. He kept it hanging on. People, don't do that. If your cat is dying, let it die. But in any case, so finally...
Even if it's not dying.
No. But people really do let their cats
just
live
to be safe.
Cats don't like to be in pain and suffering and
I
taking
know,
off.
I'm,
but in
I'm
any case, so what was cut out of the film was that at the when they finally decided the cat did need to go to kitty heaven, Kubrick actually said to Leon, you know what, put it in a bag and I will shoot it with a gun.
Yes. What?
He did.
What?
And
no.
They had that and the way they presented it in the film was so funny. I remember I was crying laughing. They presented it. It was so funny the way Leon told the story. So I have a feeling Christiane or Jan Harlan, his wife or his brother-in-law, said, that makes him sound a little too crazy. We don't want you to put that in the film. I noticed at the end of the film, there was no thanks to Christiane and Jan Harlan, who are the normally, you know, kind of the Kubrick estate. So it's possible they weren't crazy about this film. The film really does show a little bit of Kubrick's dark side, which you don't see in any production that the Kubrick estate is participating in. I've noticed that. They don't like him to look crazy or kooky. And so I think that you definitely see there's a dark side to Kubrick in this film. I think it's great for those of us who are fans. I think he was human. I think he was a very powerful man at a time when powerful men did wield their power in slightly irresponsible ways sometimes. And that's what life, it's real. So I think it's great that we get a glimpse of this. I have a feeling people weren't thrilled about it. But in any case, luckily they decided not to shoot the cat. But it just shows how, like, that weird non-human side of him. He loved his animals. He had so much love for them. But he thought in a way that was so outside of the norm, and which ultimately was part of his genius,
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. So and so I got to talk to Leon afterwards. I asked him about the ball, the tennis ball being pink, because I've talked about that on the show. When the ball rolls up to Danny, it's pink. It's not yellow. And he was totally shocked. He had no idea. So that was interesting because he oversaw a lot of the color, for the color for the Blu-ray. So I'm hoping that this moves along a process to get that color. That's an error in the movie that I think I've brought to a lot of people's attention and hopefully they'll fix that. So Megan, I hope you get to see Film Worker.
Yeah, I hope so. I'll looking up online, see if it comes around here.
And you can, the Taschen book for Through a Different Lens, Stanley Kubrick Photographs, can be it's available at the City of New York, but you can order it in advance on Amazon. Mid-June it comes out.
Thank you.
Thank you for making it through this far in the movie with me, you guys.
Yay!
Thanks to Megan Dooley from the West Coast and from the East Coast, New Yorker cartoonist Joe Dater, we hit the midway point. I had earlier this week put up a episode that is a best of, kind of little bits and pieces from every single episode of the first 6 months in a nice little 40-minute package. So if you know people who haven't heard the show, but you know they're Shining fans or they're fans of movie podcasts, please do pass that along. I would love to try to draw in some more people. Also, if you enjoy the show, please, even if you don't listen on iTunes, do go over to iTunes, click subscribe, and even more importantly, leave a review. That would be greatly appreciated. Every time I see a really nice review, honest to God, I get choked up. Like, I can't tell you how happy it makes me. It makes it all worthwhile. So thank you to everybody who's ever left a nice review, and I really appreciate it. We are on Facebook, of course, and Twitter. Please join us there, The Shining 237. I have a Patreon where for a small subscription, you can get bonus content and stickers. And I also still have a tip jar. So if you just want to make a one-time contribution to help the show out, I'll put a link up to that on my website, theshining237.com. And please tune in next week when our guest is the Flophouse's Dan McCoy, where we will meet two lovely ladies in the bathroom of room 237. You will love them both, I guarantee. Midnight, where the stars and you.